want you to listen to a verse. It's from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1, verse 1. You can turn there if you want, but I really want you just to listen to it. It's not our text for today. And it goes like this. So this first verse of the Gospel of Matthew. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now I'll say that again. I want you to listen for any key verbs or nouns. So not words like the, T-H-E, words that have more significance. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, son of David, the son of Abraham. So did you get any key verbs there? You should be shaking your heads no, because I don't think there's a verb in there. but how about key nouns? There's record, there's genealogy. Did you catch that it's not Jesus, but Jesus the Messiah? That's going to have significance. And he's the son of David, the son of Abraham. David actually comes first. Maybe Matthew will talk about him being the Davidic king. And do you get this feel of tradition, his Jewish background and roots? That's a lot of what Matthew is about. I mean, we can guess some of the things that God will teach us through the book of Matthew by that one verse alone. So before we get into the Psalms, which is our real topic for today, I want to show you another example or two of how the beginning of something can let you know what the rest of the book is about. And this is not a new skill that you have to learn. This is not something foreign or alien to you. We all do this already. So to try to give you an example of this, I'm going to use some kids' books. So you don't have to be a parent to kind of play along with this game. So the first book we're going to look at is a Berenstain Bears book. So here's how it works. I'm going to read the first page, actually the first two facing pages. So you can't see the text, but all I have to do is listen. And I'm going to have you tell me, or more properly, because we're not going to bring a mic around, just turn to the person next to you, kind of whisper to them, what you think the book is about. So just like with Matthew, we're going to try to guess what might the book be about based on the first page or two. And it won't tell us explicitly what the book's about. It's going to set us up for it. So here we go. It had been a wonderful summer for the Bear family. They had gone swimming and boating at the lake. They had picnicked in the woods and taken many walks along sunny paths. But now, summer was just about over. There was a nip in the air. The birds were beginning to fly south, and the leaves on the treehouse were changing colors. All right, they're bopping around, they're happy, summer's over, but a couple leaves in the air, temperature's dropping just a little bit. So turn to your neighbor, even if they're a stranger, maybe try it, and give him a little whisper, say, I think the story is about, fill in the blank. Now, I don't know that you'll be able to guess exactly. I mean, there might be one of two or three or four options here. So I don't think we can nail it right on the head based on that first facing page. But let me kind of give you a little more of a clue. This is about a family, right? The family has kids, right? It's a kid's book meant to be read to children, right? The kids are supposed to learn lessons from this thing, right? So combine family, kids, kids learning something with a change of seasons, and maybe what is one guess? School. Little sister Bear is going to go to kindergarten for the first time. So she's bopping around with a smile on her face here, but one or two pages into the book, she's got this worried expression on her face, like, I don't want to go to school. I like being with my family. So the story is all about that. Let's do one more. This one you have to pay close attention to the words, but the clues are there. This one you can actually narrow it down pretty well about what the story is about. This is the story about two bears. So kind of in a bear theme today, I guess, to start with. And here's the first page. Once there were two bears, Big Bear and Little Bear. I love these short sentences. They're just awesome. Once there are two bears, big bear and little bear. Big bear is the big bear, and little bear is the little bear. They played all day in the bright sunlight. When night came and the sun went down, Big Bear took Little Bear home to the bear cave. Now let me read it again. All the clues are there for you. And I'll give you a hint. It's not in that first sentence or two, once there were two bears, Big Bear and Little Bear. A little bit later. But the clues are all there. So listen carefully. Once there were two bears, Big Bear and Little Bear. Big Bear is the big bear, and Little Bear is the little bear. They played all day in the bright sunlight. When night came and the sun went down, Big Bear took Little Bear home to the bear cave. All right? Time's up. Lean to your neighbor and tell them what the story's about. As you're thinking, I'll try to help you out here. I'll read you the key sentences, and I'll try to even emphasize those words a little bit for you. It's kind of like when you play Scrabble at home. You know, some people are really good at it, and they just throw out these five-syllable words, and you're thinking of boy, ball, you know, you're thinking of the most basic words in the world. So some of you are going to get this. Some of you are going to go like, I'm lost in this thing. So listen to these sentences. They played all day in the bright sunlight. Why don't you just say they played all day? Or even they played all day in the sun. But it's not just sun. It's bright sunlight. You look at the page and that sun is really reflecting off the snow. But it's going down because the shadows are growing. Then the sentence after that, when night came and the sun went down. Doesn't that sound redundant? When night came and the sun went down. Why would you say that twice? Why not just say, when night came? When night came and the sun went down. What's the story about? Darkness. The bright day is over. They've played in it. They've had a great time. The bright sunlight is leaving. The sun goes down and darkness comes. It's about baby bear or a little bear being scared of the dark. So Father Bear puts him in bed and he comes out. So every parent in the room knows what that's all about. And there's not enough light. Now, that takes us to our first question in your notes, which is, we already answered it really, what is one of the most important parts of a book? And we're going to test it out with Psalms. We've already tried it with Matthew. But it really can apply to any book. And the answer is very simple. The beginning. If you take notes, that's all you have to write down. The beginning. One of the most important parts of a book. So since we've answered that, let's go on to question two. What are the Psalms about? Well, we're going to answer that by filling in some blanks in your sermon notes. But do we need to read through all 150 Psalms to answer that? Well, to answer it fully and completely, yes. But we could posit a guess as to what the Psalms are about based on the beginning of the whole Psalter, which is a term some people use for the whole book of Psalms. So let's apply what we learned in Matthew and the bear books and say, let's just look at the beginning to see what the Psalms are about. So I'll read from the first Psalm. Verse 1, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law, God's law, he meditates day and night. If you look back up at verse 1, you might guess, and you'd be right, that the Psalms are going to be a lot about being blessed, being someone who's blessed, has joy in his or her life, versus the wicked. And you could even do a word study on blessed, kind of search for it in English, find the passages that have it, and make your own list about, in God's view, how do I lead a life that's blessed and not a life that's wicked? Well, here's one thing you'd put on that list right here, meditating in God's word. So in Psalm 1, there's an idea here. So here's your fill in the blanks. And the idea is blessed versus wicked. So that's all in one line in your notes. You'd put blessed, then slash, you'd put wicked. Because we read about the wicked in verse 4, not just verse 1. Verses 1 through 3 are all about the blessed man or woman, and verses 4 through 6 are about the wicked. Now, the cool thing to me about the Bible, or one of many cool things, is that God does not just talk in concepts or ideas like blessed or wicked, but he communicates in pictures. So he's going to give us a visual, an illustration, an example to show us what this is like. And you probably, many of you might know this already. In verse 3, we read about the picture of the blessed man. He will be like a tree, firmly planted by streams of water, yields its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither. Whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked have a picture with them too, but it's chaff, which the wind drives away in verse 4. Chaff is that bit of leaf and stalk, all dried up, no water content anymore, that's left when you just very softly grind so you don't hurt the head of grain, a stalk. So you separate the grain from the leaf around it. And then in ancient days, they would throw that up in a light breeze. The wind would carry the bits of leaf away, and the heavier heads of grain would fall back in their blanket. Then they're good to go. Make bread, take it to market, do whatever they wanted to do. Now, the book of Psalms is a lot about the blessed man or woman versus the wicked. So two paths that individuals can go down. However, Psalm 2 is a second introductory psalm to the whole book of Psalms. The middle of Psalms, kind of the meat of the book of Psalms, begins at book 3. So let's read some in Psalm 2. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And what they're going to say is, we don't want your authority over us. We want to be independent. We want to be our own king. We want to be God in our lives. So here's the idea in Psalm 2. The idea in Psalm 2 is authority versus slash rebellion. And that idea is going to get fleshed out in pictures. So let's look back at Psalm 2. In verse 6, God has installed his king upon Zion. And in verse 7, God the Father calls that king his son. And these kings that rebel against the son, in verse 9, God's son will break them with a rod of iron, and he'll shatter them like earthenware. So here's the picture in Psalm 2. You've got a king that God appoints, and you've got the people that rebel against the king who end up being potsherds. So we don't have that term much anymore these days, but in ancient times, all of their utensils were made of clay, and you could break that by accident. So all these bits of a broken pot would line your floor. You'd sweep them into a corner. Eventually, you'd have a kid take them outside, throw them away. To us, it'd be like bits of a broken beer bottle lying on the side of a road or alley somewhere. I mean, are those worth anything? Do we pick those up and collect them and say, whoa, I found a little piece of glass that's real sharp and got a point on the end? No. We see them as a nuisance. We don't want to step on them or ride our bikes over them. So the book of Psalms is also going to be about a king, a Davidic king. It'll start out being David, the real David, but it'll end up being Jesus, the final and great Davidic king. And it's about the systems of this world that rebel against that king. Now look at Psalm 3. Here we have a superscription, which is small, point size of a font, under the heading of Psalm 3, but before verse 1. It's not added in by like modern-day commentators or authors. It's really part of the Hebrew text. So it's something God wants us to know. And this says, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. And Psalm 3 begins the story of Davidic kingship in Israel. And along with that story, looking at individuals like David, remember back to Psalm 1, the blessed man versus the wicked man, and what those individuals did to seek out God in his face. In fact, the first part of Psalms is a lot about David fleeing from Saul, who's trying to kill him, hiding out in caves in the wilderness, He's left his family in Jerusalem. He's left his home. He's left his job. He's being hunted down as a criminal. So is David suffering? By all means, yes. And so it's neat to look in the first part of the book of Psalms to see, what does he do in the midst of that suffering? How does he seek out God's presence? But Psalm 3 begins that story. So to recap, Psalm 1, an introduction to the whole book of Psalms, part of its beginning. Psalm 2, also part of its beginning, a general psalm about Davidic kingship, God's authority, and people that rebel against it. So ready for our next question, which is, how many books are there in the book of Psalms? You may not even know this, and so maybe let's turn to Psalm 41. So you need a Bible for this. If you don't have one, there are ones at the end of aisles, especially up near the tech booth. The book of Psalms has 150 psalms altogether. And so what God has done is he's broken these down into five sections. So our answer here is just the number five. That's the answer. And here's how you can see where one of these takes place. At the end of Psalm 41, right before Psalm 42, all of your Bibles, doesn't matter what English translation or what foreign language you have even, will have above the heading of Psalm 42 the title Book 2. So if you're looking at a Bible and it has Book 2, will you raise your hand a little bit or nod your head or do something? I mean, everyone is doing, yep, it's there, it's right there. So 150 psalms, they're not evenly divided up. If you know math, I think that'd be like 30 psalms, and then you hit the end of Book 1. So it's not quite what you and I might do. They're done more by topic. And what we're going to do is see, if we would read through the book of Psalms, a development of Davidic kingship, starting with the real David and ending up with Jesus. Kind of going through history, but not all the way back to Adam, not all the way back to Abraham, but starting with David, not even starting with his younger life, but when he is in the desert, fleeing from Saul and later Absalom, but before he actually got installed permanently as king. Now, next question, why five? I mean, why not 3 or 10 or something like that? We really don't know the answer, but what I want you to write down is the best guess we can make, and that is the books of Moses, or the Torah, which is a capital T-O-R-A-H. So the first section in the whole Bible is one section of five books: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, end of the books of Moses. And it seems like God has put books together in groupings for us. In the major prophets, like Isaiah and Jeremiah, there are five books in the major prophets. In the books of poetry and wisdom, like Psalms would be one of those books, and Proverbs would be one of those books. In the books of poetry and wisdom, there are five books. The other number that things seem to be organized around is the number 12. There are 12 minor prophets. This is at the end of your Old Testament. Those guys you probably haven't read very much and don't understand too much about. Guys like Haggai and Malachi and Zechariah. And there are 12 historical books, 12 books of history, like 1 and 2 Samuel. So that's our best guess as to why there are five. Next question. Are there smaller groupings? This is one that really fascinates me, and I encourage you to use this as you read through the book of Psalms on your own. Are there smaller groupings, meaning not just Psalms 1 through 41, which is the first book of the Psalms? And the answer, which you might guess, is just going to be a very simple yes. So just yes, there are. And for me to introduce to you how this kind of thing works, I want to show you a term. So here's a little sub-question in question 5. What connects a door to its frame? So when you're walking around your house, you got all these doors, right? Exterior doors, interior doors. What is it that connects that to the door frame around it? You might be thinking hinge, and you're right. I'm actually looking for something more specific. It's part of the hinge assembly, and it's called, I mean, it goes by a couple different names, but I would call it a pin or a hinge pin. So the answer here, you can do it two words or hyphenate it, is hinge pin. And this is that little thing, maybe you've never done this, but if you want to take a door off its frame, you get a finishing nail or a real thin Phillips head screwdriver, get a hammer, and from underneath you can pop up that pin and take it out. And once you take out three, the door is going to fall out. So the pin connects the door to its frame. It connects two things together in a real solid, great way. And they won't get separated. So what God has done is he's taken psalms and he's used words and phrases as hinge pins to connect one psalm to another. In other words, they're not randomly, you don't take 41 psalms and just randomly throw them together. There's a rhyme and reason to what's happening. So let's look at a few examples here. Turn up to Psalm, or maybe back to Psalm 24. Here is just two verses at the end of Psalm 24. So start reading at verse 7. And as I read this, let's see if you can pick up on what word gets repeated at the end of Psalm 24. Verse 7. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Skip up to verse 9. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. So the word that gets repeated there is lift or lift up. Now, look at Psalm 25, first verse. So very next psalm. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. See the connection? We end up a psalm where the psalmist says to these gates, lift up your heads and welcome in the King of glory, this Davidic king. The next psalm, the psalmist says, I lift up my soul. The gates do their thing. I'm going to lift up my soul to welcome in this king as well. So whoever God has inspired to put the whole book of Psalms together, what he's doing is he's looking at all these psalms, and he found a psalm that ends up with lift up repeatedly. And he thinks, oh, wait a minute, man, on my table way off in that corner, there was another scroll that has a psalm on, and it began with lift up. I'm going to put those two together because they go together. And that's his hinge pin that connects one to the other. What's cool is while you're reading through the Psalms, but you got to read more slowly, you might want to do a computer printout so you can feel free to mark everything up and even make mistakes. You can circle these words or highlight them or underline them and see the connections between Psalms and determine, hey, there's a grouping of three in a row, or these five go together because they all have the same vocabulary term, or these two are buddied up because they have the same topic. Another example, we'll stay in Psalm 25 and go toward the end. So what is at least one thing that's going to link Psalm 25 with 26? That's our question here. Well, at the end of Psalm 25, verse 21, let integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. In fact, in verse 21, that word integrity is another key word that goes throughout book 1. David is what? Not really king yet, but about to be king, going through a lot of suffering. So what you'll see crop up is words like integrity and uprightness. He cares about his own soul. He's going to preach to himself to make sure he's right with God. And so you'll see integrity and God's presence, which he seeks, a lot in book 1. In fact, Ryan will talk about that next weekend when we start our 5 days of prayer as a church. And Ryan will focus on Psalm 16, especially verse 11. So the word here in Psalm 25 is integrity. And guess how Psalm 26 begins, verse 1 of Psalm 26. Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. And I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. So there's our hinge pin between Psalm 25 and Psalm 26. One more example. Go back to Psalm 15. And let's read just verse 5. Psalm 15 is again about seeking God's presence. David asks the question, who can dwell in your presence, on your hill, with you? And it's kind of neat the way he answers it. I love Psalm 15. He doesn't say the person who goes to church every Sunday or lifts his hands in worship or reads his Bible 5 hours every day. He says other things which are neat to read about. But here's how it ends. He, this person who can dwell with God, does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. So he's very generous with his money. He who does these things will never be shaken. Now, how do I know what the hinge pin is between 15 and 16? I don't until I read Psalm 16. Because there are going to be a lot of nouns and verbs in Psalm 15, right? I can't like circle all of them. Only some of them are going to carry over to Psalm 16. But let me tell you that once I've read Psalm 16, I go back to Psalm 15 and I'm going to circle or highlight the words, never be shaken. Now, why would I do that? Because let me read Psalm 16 into verse 8. I have set the Lord continually before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. And I think, man, I just came across not being shaken. One psalm previous. That's at least one hinge pin between these two psalms. There might be a second and a third, but at least that one I can circle and link up the two and say these psalms are grouped together. They're going to talk about what it means if we want to not be shaken by the turmoils or distresses of life around us. So that actually brings us to our final question, which is, what is the focus of Book 1? I've talked about this a little bit already. In Book 1, let's go back to Psalm 3. David is not king yet, but he's about to be king, going through very intense suffering, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So let's read Psalm 3, which is the real beginning of Book 1. O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Actually, that's another theme you'll see repeated in Book 1. A lot of enemies surrounding David, trying to attack him. Many are saying of my soul, there's no deliverance for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. Now, here's the neatest thing about Book 1. Book 1 has compliment and complaint, and maybe worded as compliment over complaint, more important than complaint. So that's kind of your answer to the focus. It's about complimenting God in the midst of some complaining. So let me kind of explain what I mean by all that. You might not like the word complaining, but I'm using it in a softer sense. So David's not complaining out of bitterness. You might want to prefer request instead of complaint, that he's asking God for things. But complaint in a softer way can be a totally fine thing. Carla, my wife, is seated up there with me, and like a week ago, I opened up the fridge door, and there's no ketchup there. So without being bitter, without attacking Carla, I kind of complained. It's like, there's no ketchup, honey. Next time you go to the grocery store, will you please get some ketchup? That's a request, and it's a softened kind of complaint. It's important to me because to me, ketchup is one of the top 10 inventions of all time. It's kind of up there with the digital camera. I mean, when the digital camera came out, it's like, oh, this is fantastic. I don't have to develop film anymore, and I can take as many as I want and then delete them. Well, combining tomato sauce with a lot of sugar is just one of those things. It's brilliant. But I was complaining without attacking and without kind of trying to impugn her character. It was just like, I need my ketchup. You know, can you pick some up in the near future? So Book 1 is going to have complaint, or if you prefer, request. But what's neat is that David never makes request or complaint without praising or complimenting God. And in fact, the praise and compliment takes precedence over the complaint. Now think of how amazing this is. Unless you happen to pray like David, but my guess is most of us don't pray like David. With most of us, when we pray to God, the request or the complaint predominates. And sometimes it's there 100%. At least if you're like me. If you're not like me, if you're like Ron, I have no idea what you're talking about. Man, that's great. But often our prayers are, maybe they start with a real quick kind of token praise, like, Father in heaven. So we're calling God our Father, but we zip over that real quick. And then what often are our prayers, you know, consisting of? God, my mom is sick and in the hospital. Please take care of her. My car is breaking down and I know it needs to get fixed and I don't have money, like Zach talked about. You know, can you please help me fix my car? God, I may not have a job 2 months from now. Can you please find me a job? Even if I have a job, I want a much better paying one. Can you please get me a better job? And on and on. So it's A, B, C, D, E, just a shopping list, basically, of things we need. I don't have my ketchup. I need my ketchup, except it's much more important. Now, is it okay to pray about a sick mother or a relative that's in the hospital? Of course it is. Does David cry out for himself? And does he use sentences that start with I need this, I'm requesting this? Of course he does. The point is, he always compliments God along with that. And that's the neat thing about book one. Now, I want to kind of start an informal series where I go through the five books. And so in November, I'm going to sub in for Ryan a couple times, and we'll look at book two. Well, if book one is about suffering and complimenting God while you're suffering, what is book two about in book three and book four and book five? Also on our website, on the very first page to the left, I've put up notes on all five books if you want to look that out and kind of look ahead to see what the other books are about. But here are one or two exercises for you guys. As you think about this idea of compliment and complaint going together, since we're real heavy on the complaint side, or if you're like me, you're real heavy on the complaint side, and doing this list, I need this, I need you to do this for my aunt, I need this for my son, I need this for my workplace, I need this money for myself and my wife or husband. If you're heavy on that kind of praying, then try this. Take 10 minutes, I mean, you could try it later today or tonight, and do nothing but compliment God. So no request, no softened complaint, only compliment. Now, I'm assuming you guys know what a compliment is. Yes? Can you nod your heads? I mean, husband, wives, you know what a compliment is. I mean, you've had probably times where, speaking for the guys, you know, all of a sudden you've looked back and you've said, oh man, the last 2 weeks I've done nothing but complaints, hopefully soft complaints, and requests, and asking for things and saying, I need this, and I've done no complimenting. I've not complimented my wife on what she is on the inside or the outside, or all the things she's done for our family. And you know what happens to a marriage if that keeps going. I mean, what if you did a year, two, 3 years of only telling somebody, I need this, I want this, can you do this for me, can you get this ready tomorrow, and no compliment? I mean, that's a marriage headed for divorce right there. So there's got to be that balance. You've got to tell somebody what you need and be assertive and say and not be quiet, but it has to be joined up with compliment. So your exercise is try 10 minutes of only complimenting God. Now, here's why that's going to be hard, unless you've developed this as a practice in your prayer life. It's going to be hard because either, one, you may run out of things to say after 2 or 3 minutes. It's a really sad thing, but you may run out of things to say. Now, is that because there aren't dozens and hundreds of attributes of God, things that he is and things that he's done, that could keep you busy for hours? No. That's because we don't know that many, that we haven't studied the scriptures to learn the dozens of things that God is and that he's done. That's one reason why it may be hard. The second reason is that you may find yourself falling into request or complaint, even though your goal is 10 minutes of praise. This is what happened to me the first time I tried this. I got like 2 minutes into it, like, God, you're faithful. I thank you for Jesus and all that he is. I thank you for my family. I thank you just for being the kind of God you are. I thank you so much for my wife, Carla. And man, she's going through a hard time at work. Can you please help her to relate to her docs at the workplace? And I'm like, oh, no. You know, it only lasted 2 minutes. And then, because I was thanking God for Carla, and she was having a difficulty with the family practice she was working with, I started falling into requests. It's just part of our, I guess, you know, American Christian culture kind of a thing. Or maybe it is what it means to be a human being, that we focus on us too much. So here's the idea. If you can do 10 and then maybe even 15 or 20 minutes of just praise, thanksgiving, compliment, then you can bring the request back in. It's easy to bring the request back in, right? We do that naturally. And then you'll balance things out. But if right now you're like me and you're way, the scales are way too tipped on request and complaint, then go the opposite direction so you can come back to a proper balance that we'll see in David's life as we read through book one. Here's the second and final exercise I want you guys to do. If you feel up to it. At the bottom of your sermon notes, there's a little tear-off card. You know what? Let's all tear that off together. I mean, grab that baby, find the little perforated thing. Let's just get some paper ripping noise going on here. So tear that thing off. There, what a great sound. It's like this chorus of stuff. I think you guys know what we usually use this for. If you're a visitor, and we still want you to do this, if you're a visitor, please fill it out. Come up front at the end of the service. There will be some people up here, men and women, that would love to meet you. And if you don't have time to just let us get to know your name and your face and you're a visitor, then put that in the offering boxes at the back of the sanctuary as you leave. The other side is for a prayer request. And every Sunday people fill these out, and they should. It's a right biblical thing to do, saying, my wife has cancer, and it's just going to be a difficult week coming up. Will you please pray for her? She's got an appointment with the doctor again. And both the elders and the staff do pray for every one of these every week. I want you to do something different today, and all of you could do this if you choose to. Instead of writing a request, write a compliment. You to God, as if you were praying back home on your knees by yourself right now, write a compliment. And then maybe sign your first name at the end. Maybe not. You don't have to. So maybe you'd say, thank you for your faithfulness, God. I'm not faithful to you, but I know you're faithful to me, Susan. It'd be so neat if we could read through dozens of people from Desert Springs, or even visitors, that would take the time to praise and compliment God and not make requests of him. When we, you know, you'd put those in the offering boxes too in the back. When we empty those boxes, start leafing through these tear-off cards.